You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, as children return to school, demand for COVID-19 tests rose around the state. We'll get an update on the availability of tests and which local governments are keeping mask mandates and other health measures in place. But first, we stick with jobs. Last week here on Central Time, we spoke about the Labor Department's most recent jobs report, and no surprise, we've got record-high job openings. We also talked about the ongoing number of people leaving the workforce, the Great Resignation, as it's been called. This week, we tackle another piece of the picture, organized labor. With more than a dozen strikes authorized or happening this month in a variety of job sectors, we wanted to take a look at what's going on to try to understand what's happening and what these movements can tell us about the state of work in this country. We want to hear from you. Is there a current strike or a negotiation that's captured your attention? Well, bring it to ours. We're at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Michael Childers, professor at UW-Madison School for Workers. He spent many years teaching on labor management relations. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Molly.
So the big news today, we were thinking today there could be thousands of workers walking off the job in Hollywood, big production studios perhaps ground to a halt without thousands of stagehands and other workers, members of the International Alliance of the Theatrical and Stage Employees Union, IATSE. But over the weekend, we learned union leaders reached a tentative agreement with the studios to prevent the strike. What's the latest, Michael?
I think you just covered it. I think what's interesting is in IATSE's history is they've never actually gone on strike before. And this was an interesting time of their negotiations in that, well, you nailed it. I think all of us, after being stuck inside for so long, were pretty anxious to see new versions of the shows that they like and some of the new shows that are coming out. And that's led to a high demand for their labor. And honestly, it's one of the major issues that they were bargaining around, which is limits on excessive overtime and guaranteed breaks in terms of the number of days consecutively, et cetera, that they could work.
And so what do we know about the deal that they've reached now, the kind of key sticking points? You mentioned kind of a 10-hour work end of the work day.
I think actually, if I from some of the preliminary reports I've seen, it's going to limit the maximum per day to 14 hours, which 14. Is still an extremely long day, right?
Yeah.
We had original strikes over the 8-hour workday back in the late 1800s in this country. I think what's interesting, though, also is people aren't necessarily clear exactly how the whole process works when a union bargains with their employer. But in this case, the tentative agreement only means that they're now going to take the deal out to, and in IATSE's case, it's a little different as well. It's not actually members that will get to vote on whether or not to accept the terms of the agreement, but their elected representatives. So it's sort of like a representative democracy, like our Congress works, where it's not going to go out to all the members to vote on this. It's just going to go to certain elected leaders. And in this case, it's the leaders of the what they call, I'm doing air quotes, the Hollywood locals are the ones that have reached this tentative agreement.
So this affects just those bargaining units that were involved. So not necessarily all over the country, just the ones involved in directly with the Hollywood studios.
Yes and no, because that's exactly right. But that tends to set the pattern for what the rest of the country is going to basically be getting. In terms of that's sort of the major employer, those major studios, and now at this point, that includes Apple and Netflix. They set the bar, and then pretty much the subsequent contracts will mirror that contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so 14-hour days. What else was at issue with this contract?
Well, and let's be clear, it's not necessarily that they have to, it's that they wanted a ceiling on it. They wanted a
Yes.
cap. Because, and then you have to remember the context of LA too, right? Where a 2 hour commute is not unheard of. So you're talking about people, even with that cap, 17 hours door to door, right? In terms of their jobs, like it's almost like sleep in your car at that point. So, I mean, that was just one of the sundry issues. Obviously, pay is a big deal. I mean, the economy has seen a lot of pent-up demand, so of course workers are always looking for a raise. But yeah, there were many issues around working conditions, and I think they got some health and safety gains that they've been looking for in this tentative agreement. So we'll see where that goes.
All right. Well, also news recently, John Deere, 10,000 United Auto Workers going on strike last week, still continuing. What's at the heart of that debate?
It's interesting because they're all unique in their own way, which is kind of amused me as I've seen the hashtag Striketober trending. Because again, the workers are all individual locals, or in this case, a group of locals. It's the locals that are in Iowa and Illinois, that are members of the United Auto Workers. And they all have their own issues, right? They all have their own individual bargain with their employers. I would say that there is a common thread, though, and that the theme is around, especially like in this strike, in the Kellogg strike, in the strike that happened against Nabisco by the bakery confectionery workers. It's a pushback against workers giving up even more of their pay and benefits. In a time when these companies are realizing, in John Deere's case, shattering their former profit records. So I think it's also important to keep in context with Deere that not only are they shattering their former records in terms of generating profit, their last collective bargaining agreement did not sail through. It ended up being ratified by only a couple of hundred votes in 2015. So there's been some discontent for a while. And again, there's been some, the UAW has struggled at the international level in terms of leadership and had some malfeasance where they had to root that out. So I think on the local level, these folks are frustrated with Deere and they're a little maybe energized in terms of feeling like, look, we've generated this wealth for the company. We don't understand why you're coming to try and take some of our benefits.
So, Michael, do you think that this is happening right now that we're seeing, you mentioned the Nabisco strike, we've seen coal miner strikes, nurses. Do you think this is happening because of these macroeconomic factors of unemployment and so many jobs being open right now? What do you attribute?
And both, I think that's like that's the general context, right? I mean, you can understand what in I think the pandemic has an impact in that it's created this opportunity for many people to rethink, where am I at? Where do I want to be? You mentioned it in your intro that many people have become discouraged and are just opted out of the job market or reconfigured their lives where they figured out, based on what I was paying for childcare in this country, maybe I am better off staying at home. And again, I think it's in different segments of the economy, it's impacting in different ways. But I would absolutely agree with the idea that the pandemic, and then now, again, this pent-up demand that's occurring for in John Deere's example. I mean, in Kellogg's example too, right? Cereal wasn't a big growth industry until you couldn't go out for breakfast, and then suddenly demand is up for that. And yet, even as Kellogg realizes record profits, workers are being basically asked. And in that case, it's a little different. Well, it is similar actually to what's going on with the Deere, in that the proposals that the workers are faced with are essentially, we want to take some of your benefits, but then even on a bigger scale, we want to change where new employees will start in terms of the benefits that they'll start with or even have available to them. And what I'm thinking of particularly is, for example, access to like a defined benefit pension.
Okay. We're speaking with Michael Childers, a professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers. He spent many years teaching labor management relations at the Wisconsin School of Business. Conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking with Michael Childers, professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers. We're talking about workers, specifically the ones around the country in all over who've either gone on strike, authorized a strike, maybe avoided a strike thanks to some last-minute negotiating. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. How are you viewing what's happening right now in organized labor? Are you affected by any of the current disputes? Tell us how things look where you're sitting. We're at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can always shoot us an email, ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Michael, we were talking about some of the macro factors going on in the economy that have kind of positioned workers with more leverage right now. What do you think this means for the future of organized labor? If that's not too big a question.
Well, I don't know that we have enough time for that one, but I'll take a bite at the apple. I'll just say it this way. I think organized labor has been declining in numbers and percentage, market share, however you want to say it, for many years, right? Going back even, you know, the major precipitous decline started like in the early 80s in our country to where now it's, you know, barely 11% of the whole workforce and less, around 6% or a little bit less nationally in the private sector. I guess I would say that workers always want to be heard at work. They want a voice at work, and they want to feel like they're getting fair compensation in terms of that they get an equitable deal from their employers. And the way the system works in the United States, the really only way that you're guaranteed to be able to pursue those and not be arbitrarily dismissed is through collective bargaining. I think there's been a lot of news here lately around LGBTQ rights, the Me Too movement, where you've seen activists in different companies, Google, Facebook, Apple, summarily dismissed for bringing up, I think, what issues that most people would tend to agree with. But, you know, in that situation, if you're not in a situation where you're seeking to bargain collectively with your employer, then you really have no legal protections. And again, I think the job market, especially on the low end of the economy, or I guess on the entry level or the low wage service industry, the pandemic has definitely had an impact there, right? Because you almost eliminated hospitality immediately in terms of both restaurants and hotels, et cetera, for a fair amount of time there, which caused people to rethink, is 233, does that really make sense to work for that kind of an hourly wage? What are my other options?
Right. Well, Michael, the other thing I'm wondering too, though, is that for the sectors that you mentioned who could pay more, why aren't we seeing kind of are we seeing wages increase to, you know, as companies compete to try to attract a workforce?
I think we have. And I mean, we all have. I think if you follow the labor market at all, you've heard about the organizing efforts that have happened at various Amazon warehouse locations. You know, for many years, it was Walmart that organized labor was really anxious and interested in organizing because, again, these are the two largest private sector employers in terms of numbers in the entire country. And as go they, so goes the labor market in terms of that, you know, Walmart did, I think, again, just raised their entry-level wages, I believe, to $12 an hour now in all markets and higher in some. So that sort of sets a floor, right, in terms of when people are looking for potential employment, they know, well, if I go here, I'll make at least this amount of money.
Well, so you mentioned Amazon, and that effort ultimately wasn't successful. What do you think went wrong there from the union perspective?
Oh, if we didn't have enough for the first question, we definitely. I guess I would just say workers will exercise their voice and make their decisions based on the information they've had. I would say the other thing that's different now than 2 years ago, besides the emergence of the COVID-19 virus, is we have a different NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, which is a result of having a different presidential administration in place. And I think that potentially this board, they've already reversed many decisions that had occurred in the previous administration and will probably continue to exercise their role as the Department of Labor and the NLRA set out for the NLRB to allow workers to exercise their rights under the act and the seeking to be represented and to bargain collectively with their employer.
So you think that those changes might mean that you'll see another organizing effort soon?
Again, it's not that there aren't organizing efforts. I think that the other thing that I got my attention about the hashtag is you need a couple of key influencers to start using the hashtag and it catches on as a euphemism, right? I think workers are always organizing. It's just that it's not necessarily news. It's like local or maybe even regional news. For example, people that hear about Starbucks from time to time, but here in Wisconsin, Collectivo recently won an election. Their workers voted to be represented and now will be bargaining collectively with Collectivo, their baristas. So again, organizing is happening. It's just that it's not super sexy usually, and it's not the thing that will grab headlines.
Sure. Well, we've got a caller for you, Michael. We're going to go to Minnesota, actually, where Randy is waiting to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Randy.
Oh, well, thanks for taking my call. On what he just got done saying about it's not sexy, so it's not really news. I think the not news part of it is that almost all of the media relies on advertising for their funding, and the advertising all comes from people who don't want collective bargaining. I don't think the big oil companies or big tech companies, none of them want collective bargaining because they don't want us regular Joes to have any power at all. And if you can't collectively bargain, you can't really do anything.
Have you had an experience, Randy, yourself with it with the union?
Well, I've been in a couple different unions, and the last one I was in for 14 years was IBEW, 292, go union. And they made some really weak moves, I thought. And the whole allowing the two-tier stuff, that's a ploy. The two-tier, that's what John Deere is on strike about now. That to allow two tiers, there's the guys who've been there a long time, and the new guys are at a lower tier, is really disruptive, and it's meant to separate. It's to ununion the union.
Yeah, let's ask Michael about that, the two-tier system where established workers have one set of benefits and then a new hires are brought in under different conditions. Michael, what
Sure, all great points, and I this goes back to an earlier point that you made, Molly, and I don't want to discount it, is that in most of these situations, when the workers have reached that point when they're ready to strike, it's because they are angry and they're frustrated because they really feel like they're not getting a fair offer from their employers. And again, he makes the point about two tiers, and I think I'd already mentioned that that was a major part of the issues with the John Deere proposal as well as the Kellogg's, why the Kellogg's proposal and why the workers at Nabisco went on strike as well. Because again, to that point, is these companies are making record profits, and yet for whatever reason, you're saying that the people here helping generate that wealth are now in the future going to be somehow worth less or less necessary. I think that even the nomenclature of the pandemic, where workers were told, you're essential, I think they're starting to believe it.
Well, we had another call come in. Tom in Milwaukee says that he saw a survey that people under 30 have more favorable views of unions than the generation prior. Do you know if that's true?
Yes, it is. And one of the oldest polls that the Gallup survey has ever run is around union favorability. And this year, it was actually in the high 60s, and it was the highest it's been since the 1960s in terms of people's overall favorability towards unions in our country. And again, I think as we went through the pandemic, I think that people saw that, you know, workers that had been in, you know, the grocery industry at one point had a lot higher density even than it has today. And these people, I guess, you know, I'll go all the way back to Dr. King, that people should not be working full time and qualify for additional federal benefits, right? That wages should pay a sustaining wage that people can live and thrive and have a decent life.
Well, Michael, we've just got a few seconds left. What are you looking for next? What are you watching? Strikes on the horizon?
I guess, again, it will come down to if there's momentum. Organized labor had proposed some reforms to fix what they perceive as problems with the ability for workers to form unions. It was called the PRO Act, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. I don't think that that has a legitimate chance of passing, but many of its provisions have been incorporated into reconciliation. So it'll be very interesting to see how many of those survive this negotiation as the sausage gets made, so to speak.
We will keep an eye on that for sure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Michael Childers, professor in the UW-Madison School for Workers. He spent many years teaching labor management relations at the Wisconsin School of Business. The State Department of Health Services has relaunched its community testing support program, providing local health departments and providers with COVID-19 testing supplies and delivery services. The average daily number of new cases in Wisconsin has been trending down during the past week, but the demand for certain types of COVID tests remains high. Shemaine Mills is a WPR news reporter covering healthcare issues. Shemaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Molly. Glad to be here.
Good to talk with you today. So tests, you know, they were scarce the first few months of the pandemic, and then it seemed like we had a supply, and now there's some trouble actually getting at-home tests in particular. What have you heard about the availability of the at-home tests?
Right. Well, it's really hit or miss. There's a nationwide shortage. So people who want this particular type of test where you get instant results can find it hard to get that test. If you go to certain pharmacy chains, they're limiting them. Walgreens, you can only get four at a time per purchase. You can go to community testing sites, but in some places like Dane County, they prioritize these quick tests for those returning to school. So if you want it for another purpose, say travel, they're going to recommend another test that goes to the lab and takes up to 3 days to get results.
Know about what's causing these shortages?
Well, as you alluded to earlier, it's the supply chain. In some instances, there just aren't enough testing materials to get to these community testing sites. In other instances, it's the worker shortage, which has affected the whole U.S. economy. I mean, a number of businesses say they can't find workers, and that's affecting production and, in some cases, the labs where these PCR tests are analyzed.
So what options do people have across the state if they're having trouble getting an at-home test?
Well, you can do like my neighbor did and just go on the listserv and ask people if they have a stash at home of quick tests, or you can go from pharmacy to pharmacy looking for one. I talked to a woman in Racine who did just that. She was going to a funeral, an indoor funeral, and she wanted to make sure that she would not be infecting others. Even though she was fully vaccinated, she wanted to take extra care. And so she finally went and got a test, but that's after going to many pharmacies. So your public health department is a good bet. Your doctor, all those places offer both the PCR test, the more reliable test, and in some cases, the quick test, depending on availability.
Can you still order them from DHS directly?
You can. However, I tried to do that, and it said it came, but I never got the test. So where it went, I don't know. I mean, at that point, I just went to public health. But it's, you know, I have not heard of a lot of people who have used that. It is one option. You do have to be witnessed on video giving the sample. So it takes some time to set up, and then you have to actually do it before sending it back. But everything is paid for. It's free.
So best option if you're having trouble finding a local option at your pharmacy, call your public health department and look for the testing sites that may still be available.
Right. They are very eager to have people tested because it's getting a little cooler. People are going to be indoors more. Many people need these tests for work or school. And with the flu season, we have a lot of people that have no idea if they're experiencing flu or COVID. And testing, of course, is one way to knock down this virus and prevent the pandemic from continuing into the winter.
Well, speaking of ways to contain the virus, is Dane County the last county with a mask mandate in the state?
Yeah, we're an outlier in that respect. We're the only countywide mask mandate. There are a few places like the city of Racine has a mask mandate, but a lot of communities around the state that had mask mandates when cases were high dropped them when cases declined during the summer.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about Milwaukee County and their decision not to put one in place?
There have been demands to re-implement the mask mandate there. My colleague Kareen Hess has reported on this, where some council members and teacher groups want a mask mandate. But public health officials there don't think that will really keep cases down and keep the virus from spreading. For one thing, Milwaukee Public Schools already make the staff and students wear masks. So that's a large piece of the population that's already wearing masks. And according to the health director there, most of the transmission is occurring in homes. So it's friends and family seeing one another, and you just can't enforce that. I mean, a mask mandate, they've been for public places, and the health directors, they can enforce restaurants, bars, and other places where people in the past were required to wear a mask, but they're not now.
Right. Well, you have been following the ins and outs, ups and downs of this pandemic. Shemaine, what are you looking at next?
I, like a lot of others, am hoping that cases continue to decline. They're still very high in Wisconsin. But the one consistent thing about this pandemic has been the virus's ability to change and outwit us. And you look at other countries where they have much higher vaccination rates than us. I'm looking at Britain and Israel, and they're seeing cases rise. So it's kind of a wild card going into the cooler weather with more people indoors. Yes, we have a vaccine. Yes, we have boosters. A number of the population, frankly, has already been infected if they weren't vaccinated. But the virus could change. A number of things could happen to deter what right now is looking like positive trends.
Well, we know you will be following it and reporting on it for us. Thank you, Shemaine.
You bet.
Shemaine Mills is a WPR reporter who covers healthcare issues. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. The reigning champions, Milwaukee Bucks, tip off their new regular season tomorrow night. To celebrate the new season, here's producer Brad Kohlberg talking with the author of a biography on Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo.
The Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions for the first time in 50 years.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
And Giannis Antetokounmpo is the superstar at the heart of the team. Not only does he have a national championship and two MVP trophies under his belt, but there's also a new biography on him. I recently talked with the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. It's about Antetokounmpo's Greek upbringing and his journey to American basketball stardom.
My name is Miran Fader, and I'm a staff writer at The Ringer.
Fader says Antetokounmpo was born in Sapolia, a neighborhood of Athens, Greece. She says life was tough. His parents had migrated from Nigeria, and they were undocumented. So finding work was hard.
So the parents would then bring the kids to sell items on the street or at upscale beaches and try to do whatever they could to put food on the table. And, you know, oftentimes they just wouldn't eat. So it was really, really tough. However, there was a lot of joy as well.
Antetokounmpo started playing basketball at age 13. He couldn't play on the elite local teams because of his immigration status, but some NBA scouts started to take notice anyway. By 2013, an 18-year-old Antetokounmpo was a scrawny but intriguing outsider as the NBA draft approached.
So the Milwaukee Bucks are choosing at number 15, and they decide to take a swing because it's Milwaukee.
With the 15th pick in the 2013 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Giannis Antetokounmpo.
And you hope to get lucky, but you expect disappointment. You don't know if this Greek kid is going to work out, but he's really tall and he's charismatic and maybe he might be okay.
Antetokounmpo ended up being more than just okay. And Milwaukee was a great fit because the team allowed him time to get acclimated to life in the NBA and the U.S.
And not having the pressure of coming in, being deified as the superstar, enabled him to grow. The only pressure that Giannis felt was, how do I provide money for my family? How do I get my family to come to America? You know, his pressures were different than the average NBA rookie.
Fader says taking care of his family was so important to Antetokounmpo because of how tight-knit they had always been.
Giannis grew up watching how his dad would pretend he wasn't hungry and give his portions to his sons. And Giannis's brothers were his best friends, his comrades. They were always laughing. They always shared everything. There was no arguments because everything was communal.
The love that Antetokounmpo had for his family was on display in 2019 when he got emotional while accepting his first MVP award. He also thanked his teammates that night and the city of Milwaukee.
And I think the thing that endears fans to Giannis most and Giannis to this city is that these fans watched him grow up. They liked that he wasn't crowned king at age 13. And they liked that this came out of nowhere. That's the ultimate lesson of all from people that come from Milwaukee. You work hard and dream big. And Giannis has done that.
And now Antetokounmpo has two MVPs and a championship. And he signed a contract extension, so his future is in Milwaukee. So what does Fader think that future might look like?
Keep in mind, Giannis is 26 years old, and he is just beginning to mature, not just into a global basketball superstar, but into a man, a father. And I think we're going to see him use his platform and his voice in bigger ways beyond the basketball court. I think Giannis is primed to become more. I think he's going to share more of himself.
Miran Fader is a staff writer at The Ringer and the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
As more and more things are bought and sold online, there's one part of the business that still requires a lot of manual labor, and that's the fulfillment warehouses. These jobs have become increasingly important as companies rush to fill orders on demand. But like other industries, companies hiring for warehouse jobs aren't able to get enough workers in the door. This is happening as the global supply chain continues to deal with big disruptions and with the holiday shopping season right around the corner. Abba Batarai has been following this story. She's a reporter covering the retail industry for The Washington Post. Abba, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Molly.
Well, good to talk with you again. So how bad is the worker shortage in warehouses across the country?
You know, for months we've been hearing about a worker shortage in many corners of the economy, and we're heading into a very busy holiday season where many Americans are expected to do a lot of shopping online, and warehouses are really struggling to hire workers. To give you a sense of how big of a need there is, there are currently about 1.4 million warehouse workers, and the industry has more than 500,000 job openings. So they're looking to, you know, ramp up in huge numbers and are running into roadblocks, finding that not that many people are interested in these positions.
Well, what do we know about why exactly, why now they're not interested in these jobs?
You know, it's many factors, but a lot of longtime workers have been working through the pandemic. They are exhausted. Many times these jobs require 10 or 12 hour shifts that are very physically grueling. During the holidays, that ends up being even longer shifts for 6, sometimes 7 days a week. So people are just exhausted. If they've worked through the pandemic, they are tired. And at the same time, if they haven't been working there through the pandemic, they're finding jobs elsewhere. You know, there's so many, we hear time and again in this economy that there are so many new opportunities for people, that workers have the leverage right now to say no to jobs that they don't want. And these warehouse jobs tend to be, you know, tend to pay about $15 to $20 an hour, not the lowest jobs out there, but also not huge amounts of money for the type of work that they require.
And so what are companies doing? What are they trying to do to recruit or retain workers right now?
We're seeing everything. We're seeing huge signing bonuses. Amazon, for example, is offering up to $3,000 for workers who sign up to work in their warehouses. Other companies are taking, you know, sort of more creative approaches. Sleep Number is throwing in a free mattress for all new hires. And Gap is offering 50% off all of its clothing. But we're also seeing pay sort of rise from $15 an hour to $19 or $20 in some cases.
Well, I wonder, too, about the supply chain disruptions that we keep hearing about. How do you think this is all going to add up for the holiday shopping season?
This is one more complication in an already really crunched supply chain. You know, I've been talking to companies for weeks now, and every step of the way has become that much harder. There are factory closures and labor shortages in Asia. There are shortages of vessels, you know, ships and shipping containers. So there are just delays along the way. There aren't enough people at the port to unload the ships once they arrive. There aren't enough truck drivers to carry these items from the ports to the warehouses. And then once you get to the warehouses themselves, we're finding that many are understaffed. And it's important to note that that's putting additional pressure on the workers that are there. You know, they say that they're extremely short-staffed and they're having to just work even more hours at even tougher paces to keep up.
Well, what do you think will happen if companies aren't able to hire as many workers as they need to keep up with this demand?
You know, I think we'll just start seeing more delays. I think we're already starting to see this expectation that things are going to be slower this year, that when you order something online, it's not necessarily going to end up at your doorstep in 2 or 3 days. So we're seeing retailers across the board, including the big ones, Amazon, Walmart, and Target, start their Black Friday sales now. They're encouraging people to shop for the holidays now. And I think a lot of that is to sort of hedge what might happen if there aren't enough warehouse workers to fulfill these orders later on.
To try to spread out that holiday shopping season over an even longer period.
Exactly.
Well, I wonder about automation. You know, I feel like we heard a lot about this kind of idea that robotics would be changing the warehouse industry and drone delivery and kind of robot scanners and sensors able to pick and pack. How much is that still on the horizon for today's warehouses?
You know, it is on the horizon. It's there. It's sort of happening in the background, but there's no working around it. I mean, these are still jobs that are going to require a lot of people for the foreseeable future. And even if, you know, more parts of the process are automated, there's still certain parts that are going to require having a person there to pick and pack these items.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned the 500,000 openings currently. Are those just for the holiday season, or do you think that's a more permanent job situation?
That's a great question. That 500,000 figure is as of August. So it might be some seasonal hiring. It might not be. But I think long term, we are going to keep seeing an increased need for warehouse workers as more people shop online. I think during the pandemic, so many Americans have really gotten to, you know, double down on their online purchases, and they've changed their shopping habits in a way that really favors online shopping and is going to create huge ripple effects further down.
Well, and do you see this shortage as providing any kind of leverage for workers to gain kind of better conditions? I mean, you've mentioned, and there's been coverage of the long hours and the harsh conditions in many places. Do you think this changes the terms at all, this shortage?
That's a great question, Molly. And that's really what everybody is wondering. We are starting to see wages rise in some cases. We're starting to see some companies split their shifts into two or three, you know, maybe 4 or 6 hour shifts that are more manageable for workers and more accommodating of their schedules. So we are starting to see changes. How far that will go, nobody really knows, but it is something that's being very closely watched.
Mm-hmm. What are you looking at next as we're kind of, I know we're poised to watch the holiday season. And as you mentioned, it's kind of spilling out early. What are you looking at next as you're following the kind of ups and downs of the warehouse sector?
You know what, I think what happens this holiday season in terms of hiring, in terms of working conditions, is going to tell us a lot about what this industry is going to look like in the foreseeable future. I mean, for so long, the retail industry has touted these warehouse jobs as the jobs of the future. You know, they're no longer sort of staffing up their stores for the holidays. They're staffing up their warehouses instead. And they really need to be able to make these desirable jobs if they're going to succeed. So much of this industry is based in has huge turnover rates. And there's this sense that, you know, workers maybe stay for a few months or a few years before they're burnt out. And until now, there's been a willing group of workers. You know, they can sort of churn through millions of people and still find people who are willing to work at these warehouses. But that's not always going to be the case. And so until we see long-term shifts in working conditions and pay, I think there's still a long way the warehouse industry has to go.
Mm. Any parts of the country that you think are hurt worse than others?
You know, it's across the board. We're seeing these warehouses all over the country, often in the outskirts of town, where they're a little bit harder to get to than your average retail store. So that's another consideration for workers. You know, they may not be able to get there by public transportation. They may need a car. And so all of that factors into quality of work-life balance and whether or not people even have access to these jobs to begin with.
Okay. Abba Badrai, that is all the time we have today. But thank you so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Abba Badrai, reporter covering the retail industry for The Washington Post.